Hello,
and welcome to episode one of Brain Cell Massacre Podcast. I'm very excited, and yeah, so in this episode, I will be covering episode two of volume two of Netflix's Unsolved Mysteries, and this is not a substitute for watching. You should absolutely go watch that. The episode is called The Death in Oslo. And also, if you have not seen or heard the trailer for this podcast, I suggest you do that just so you know what's coming. And also, disclaimer, probably not the best podcast to be listening to fall asleep, because as you probably tell, I am very loud and annoying. So, so for this episode, I have a lot to say, so I will be telling you the timeline and the theories and discussing my thoughts about that. And there is a link to my website, which has the resources I used and more episodes. So, yeah, I hope you enjoy. Okay, so we start with this ominous music, and according to captions, anxious breathing, and then we see a close-up and hear a gunshot. And then our narrator comes in. So our narrator is Lars Christian Wagner, and excuse me if I'm not saying that right. He is a feature journalist for VG Newspaper. And he starts with saying that in 1995 in Oslo, Norway, a young, elegant, unidentified woman is found dead in her hotel room, and we don't know why. Okay, so then we get the timeline, and girl, like, it's a little out of order, so I did my best to make it easy and understandable, what with the theories and stuff. So at the end of May, May 31st, to be exact, Jane Doe checks into the Plaza Hotel, room 2805, which is the most luxurious hotel in Oslo at the time. So during her stay, Jane Doe rarely leaves her room. She first entered her room on May 31st, Wednesday, at 10:44 p.m. And from here on, we only get when she enters her room because it does not register when the door is opened, only when the card is used. So she enters again at 12:21 a.m. the next day, and then she enters at 8:34 a.m. on Thursday, 8:50 a.m. on Friday, and 11:03 a.m. on Friday. So Lars looks at witness statements, and he interviews some of the maids, and we know that when two maids entered Jane Doe's hotel room a little before 1 p.m. on Thursday, the room was empty. So that means that there was no one in the room until the next morning when Jane Doe's card is used again. So that's a gap of about 20 hours. And, you know, Lars is like, okay, well, where was she? And we'll get to the theories about that later. So 3 days into her stay, one of the people at the front desk realized that Jane Doe hadn't given a credit card for the stay. And, you know, that's weird because Plaza Hotel was very expensive and luxurious. They were very strict about security, so it's almost unimaginable. That's a little dramatic, but at this point, that's one of my personality traits. It's weird that she could get a room without giving some sort of payment in advance. And if she could get in without paying, it only makes sense that she could leave, too. And, you know, you're probably thinking, oh, well, they would just track her down. But the name that she gave on the registration card turned out to be a false name, but we will get to that later. So, Saturday, June 3rd, 1995, at around 7:50 p.m., a security guard took the elevator up to the 28th floor, walked up to the door thinking he would just be like, hey, we need a credit card for this stay, and then she would hand one over, and everything would be good. So he walks up to the door, sees the Do Not Disturb sign, but ignores it, and then knocks. And a second later, he hears a gunshot. So the guard runs behind this door, draws his gun, and waits for a little while for the attacker to come out. I don't really know what I would do in this situation, but also I didn't go to like the police academy or anything. I would honestly just stand there and be like, oh shit, what do I do? But that's just me. So nobody comes out. So after waiting a couple of minutes, the guard is like, okay, well, I can't wait any longer. So he goes to get the chief of security. And while he's doing that, he's going down to security headquarters. There's a gap of about 15 minutes where the room wasn't being monitored, and this possibly allowed the unsub to escape if there was one. Unsub as in unknown subject. So the security chief goes up and he knocks on the door, and there's no gunshot this time, thankfully, but no one answered. And in my notes, I just have, yeah, no shit, buddy. So the door was locked from the inside, meaning Jane Doe or the possible unsub didn't want anyone to enter. And only security can enter the room when double locked. So the chief pulls out his security card and he opens the door. He walks in and he sees Jane Doe dead on the bed. And we get this interview from the chief. And as he's walking in, he, described smelling an acrid smell. So he's thinking, like, oh my God, she's dead. So he closes the door and he orders his colleagues to call the police. So the police arrive and they approach the room carefully and they find the body. And everything at the crime scene indicated that she had been living there alone. There was a plate of food for one, which is just your average meal with utensils, condiments, and a hot dog. So she was found in her bed on the side closer to the door, and her legs are positioned as though she were sitting on the edge of the bed and then leaned back. And her hands are on her chest, and she's holding a gun. Something weird, though, is that she was holding the gun in her hand, with her thumb on the trigger, instead of with her pointer finger on the trigger, and we'll get to that later. And we know it's the gun that was used to kill her, or whether she was the one who shot herself or it was somebody else, because the ballistics matched that of the bullet in her head. So she was gripping it, obviously, with her thumb on the trigger, and then the rest of her fingers on her right hand holding it in place. So when you first walk into this crime scene, you immediately think, oh, suicide. Which I feel horrible just saying, because you never want to just say that casually, but the evidence all points to suicide. Until you quite take a closer look, because then there isn't anything to prove that it was necessarily a murder. However, it just doesn't seem likely that it's a suicide. So the police's theory at the time was suicide, and in the police report, they said that they were 99.9% sure that it was a suicide. And the door to her room had not been opened around the immediate time of her death. So there's no evidence of a struggle, and it was only indicated that one person was living there. So the police theory was that she was a depressed woman and wanting to take her own life, and she spent a few days preparing for it. A couple things that don't fit with the suicide theory. If she killed herself and she actually spent those days preparing, you would think that she had thought about the actual death, so why would she hold the gun with such a strange grip? And also, she was neatly dressed in black and had high heels on. So why would someone dress in this way if they were just gonna take their own life? Because obviously she didn't want to be found, so why would she dress nicely? It looked like she was about to go out to the clubs or maybe a bar. So the gun that was found in Jane Doe's hand was a 9mm semi-automatic Browning pistol, and it's a pretty powerful weapon, and it would definitely recoil a lot. So, considering her weird grip, you would think it would be thrown out of her hands because Jane Doe was tiny, she wasn't tall, she had small hands, yet the gun was found in her hands. So we will also get to that later. Jane Doe had a briefcase with 25 rounds in it, but you wouldn't need 25 rounds if you were gonna shoot yourself because you would want to end your life as quickly as possible. So you would only do it with, you would only need one round. So why would she need 25 rounds? So that kind of fits the theory that she was on the run from someone and maybe she had multiple rounds to, and a pistol to protect herself. But that theory is kind of debunked by facts we learn later. So another thing that I was kind of wondering is if they checked her hands for gunshot residue or not. And I couldn't find in my research if that was a thing in Oslo in 1995. But I still thought that maybe they should have checked that, but that is just me. And obviously, if it was a professional hit, then they would know to put gunshot residue on the hands. But at least that way we would still know just in case not. So, okay, back to the weird grip thing. The way that she was holding the gun was just generally very weird because it makes the gun a lot harder to fire, and considering she had such a powerful gun, again, it would have recoiled. So, and she had 25 rounds, so I imagine she knew how to use it if it was hers. And, okay, so obviously, like, if this were like, if this were a murder, if this were a professional hit, then, and they were smart enough to not leave behind any evidence, nothing to ID her or anything like that, then why? I feel like I'm not a hit woman, so I wouldn't know, but I do feel like if you're going to stage a murder to look like a suicide, then you would, I feel like the easiest part is putting the gun in the victim's hand. But it was such a weird grip. So, like, why, if this was a professional hit, why would they put it like that? And why would she shoot herself like that? It doesn't make sense. And honestly, like, at this point, I'm wondering if it's like something paranormal. Because I am more of a person of like facts and science. But like, what else could it be? Also, they should go back to the registration card and see if the ink was smudged. Because if it was smudged in a certain direction, then we would know that she was left-handed. Because I mean, I'm not left-handed myself, but I do know plenty of people that are left-handed, and when they write, it smudges the paper. So if it wasn't smudged, then Jane Doe was probably righty. Because if she was lefty, then it's weird that she would shoot herself with her thumb on the trigger and holding the gun in her right hand. However, we do not know. So then we get this crime scene investigator, and excuse me if I'm not saying his name right. I think it's like Gare Scodge, Scouge. I don't know. I'm going to call him GS, but total respect. So his opening is very dramatic. It looks like he's just walking in an empty parking lot, and then he like sets a briefcase down and pulls out a gun, but he's out of shooting range, so. And another thing about how she's passively protecting herself and GS is that, okay, so GS is bringing an extremely similar gun to the shooting range just to show how big the recoil is, and he states that the specific weapon she was holding is more of used as an assault weapon, but not normally used to protect yourself. And like I said before, and now GS says here, if you were to hold this certain gun with your thumb on the trigger, it would be thrown out of your hands after firing. So then GS shows us a slow-mo video of him shooting the gun, which is kind of badass, but not the point. So he shoots the gun and you can see how much it recoils after you fire. So in the recreation, Jane Doe shooting herself with her thumb on the trigger, she has really nice nails. So like, girl, drop whatever nail routine you're using, because I want to use it. Anyways, when they found her and went through her room and stuff, there were no personal items to identify her. No credit card, no license, no wallet, no keys, no passport, which is weird because you need a passport to go to Norway, especially if she was from where she said she was from. There's no toothbrush, no hairbrush, no cosmetics. Again, weird because you would bring these things if you were staying somewhere, but no toiletries of any car of any kind, and nothing to ID her. So they look at her clothes next, and all of the labels on her clothes had been removed, which is very different from today. I wasn't alive in 1995, which is the earliest you can be born and still call yourself Gen Z. However, now people are extra careful to show off their tags, like, oh yeah, daddy's money can buy a lot of things. But okay, anyways, back to the timeline. So there were lots of clothes for her upper body, but like sweaters and trench coats, but not really anything from her waist and down. And obviously Lars is like, okay, well, that's weird. Like, you would need clothes for your lower body. And then again, we go back to Lars talking about how he also thinks it's weird that she was able to be given a room without any credit card, any payment, or really any other identification, and they just took her for her word. Because if she hadn't been allowed to get that, she might still be alive, or we could have figured out who her killer is if she was murdered, and we could have informed the family. But the fact that it was a five-star hotel and she didn't have to pay in advance or even show a credit card is just straight up weird. And I know I've said that multiple times, but I do feel like it is mentioned a lot in this documentary, so felt the need to bring that up. And Lars is like, well, it's a place for kings and queens and movie stars and rock stars, so they're pretty strict about security. So Lars says it's like impossible to explain this since this is a break of most of the rules at the hotel, which is just a little dramatic, but I can't really be talking. So one thing we know about her identity is what she wrote on her registration card, as I mentioned earlier. So she put her name down as Jennifer Farragut, and she also said that she was from Belgium in a street house in a tiny village. And so the Oslo police informed the Belgian police. And so they searched for her, and then they realized that Jennifer Farragut doesn't exist. She had checked in under a false name. So the police looked for fingerprints, and the only prints that were found were from our Jane Doe, or as we're gonna call her now, Jennifer. So the fingerprints were ran through Interpol, and no one reacted to it, and the results came up negative. So then the police are like, okay, well, is this maybe not a suicide? So a day or two before coming to the hotel, Jane Doe calls the hotel and she said that she was coming with a Louis Farragut, whose name was also written on this registration card. Okay, so one of the front desk operators thinks that she saw a man standing behind Jennifer, who in the reenactment is kind of cute, not gonna lie. But if you've seen Criminal Minds or pretty much any crime-related show, then you know that eyewitnesses are notoriously unreliable. They can forget, they can lie, or they can just replay a narrative over and over in their head so many times that eventually they believe it. They convince themselves that they saw something they didn't. So after that, Louis Farragut disappears, and was he ever even there? I have like a million question marks in my notes. So you're probably thinking, okay, so they searched the room. How about we check the cameras? And I was thinking this too, and we find out that the hotel did have cameras. Yay. But the police reports say nothing about the police searching them. And we didn't get the footage. No. So the police are at a loss and they don't know what to believe. So, and Lars thinks that this story is just so weird and there's not enough answers for so many questions. So if I were them, I would check missing persons reports. And they do, thankfully. However, since no one that knew her had claimed this poor girl was missing, it didn't help. And it would make sense that she didn't leave her hotel room or that no one reported her missing if she was hiding from someone or something. That theory also works, again, with the 25 rounds in her bag, but again, the gun is normally used for assault, not self-defense. So she also could have been a hit woman who was hiding from like an angry client or a survivor, and she had to run as quickly as possible and brought the gun that was closest to her, and that just happened to be the 9mm one. So also she could have been hired, and that's why she left for 20 hours, but again, I'm just kind of speculating here. It's kind of far-fetched. So for the next couple of weeks, it was a homicide investigation, but they found no new information. So they go back to the suicide theory. And they keep Jane Doe's body for a year in case they get an identity, but they didn't. So they bury her in an unmarked grave in 1996 and close the case on June 26th. So there wasn't really a funeral for her, it was just a burial, and in the footage we get, it's really empty and sad. And after the burial, that's when Lars gets involved. He was doing a story on unidentified bodies and missing people, and he felt that this was a story that he had to do. So in 1996, Lars does a story on Jennifer. And while he's researching, turns out that the village that Jennifer said she was from is called Verlaine. And turns out Verlaine exists. So Lars goes to Verlaine with Cedric Lagast, I think, and he's also a journalist. And they walk around and they show people the sketch of Jennifer and asked if they recognized her or knew what was going on. So then they talk to Hubert Jaunet, who is the mayor of Verlaine. So he claims that if she was from Verlaine, he would know her because to become mayor, he pretty much had to know everybody in this small village. So they show him the sketch of Jennifer, and he says that it, quote, doesn't ring a bell, end quote. So they go to the address that Jane Doe claimed was her home address. And the street and everything are real. However, she said that she was in 100. However, or she said that she was in 148. However, the numbers stop at 100. So Lars and Cedric are pretty sure that she was not from Belgium. However, the phone number that she gave was also consistent with where she said she was from, but the address she gave wasn't real, so they believe that she had a connection to Verlaine, but she wasn't actually from Verlaine. Okay, so back to the suicide thing. It doesn't really make sense that she had taken a shower, because if she were going to take her own life, I mean, I understand, you know, preparing yourself, that's a big deal. You're ending your own life. But I wouldn't think that she would just take a shower and, like, get all dressed up. She would probably, you know, sit on the bed, prepare, and contemplate. However, I don't have any experience in this, so I cannot speak for that kind of thing. And, okay, another thing that kind of debunks the suicide theory is that there were no blood spots found on her hand. And in most suicide cases, they're shaky because they're about to commit suicide and take their own life. So they'll put their hands around the barrel and they will get blood on their hands. At the crime scene, there was blood spots on the wall, however, not on her hands. And that's difficult to explain. One thing I don't understand is dental records. Why didn't they check dental records? Like, I mean, I know they didn't completely know where she was from, but they had an idea, and they could have gotten an identity, and dental records were a thing that were used in the identification of victims in 1995. So, I don't really understand that. However, we do get something later that, and we can identify when she was born and kind of where she's from through her teeth, and we will talk about that later. So, Lars decides to recreate the crime scene. He consults criminal experts. Wow, fancy. So an investigator from National Crime Investigation Service comes, and he says that there would have been blood on her hands and her clothes unless there was something blocking, you know, her hands from blood. He says that there would have been a person on top of her holding her hands down. They would have had to be sitting over her with their knees on her arms. And then they would have had to smother her with their hand and then fired. However, there's no clear evidence of a fight, and it would have been her natural response to fight back. So then they think of the theory, well, maybe she was drugged, and then she wouldn't have been able to resist. So Lars has a toxicology report, and we find that they only checked for alcohol. So, I mean, even if they had checked for drugs, the drugs could have already been broken down by her immune system. But, I mean, they didn't, so I guess we won't know. So, to understand this case, Lars does something that he says he does often when he works with stories, and we get this very dramatic shot of him in a big empty office typing at a computer. So he draws a timeline, and he says it's a very easy timeline to draw, and like, bro, if it was easy to draw, I think he could have given it to us in order in the documentary, girl, but that's just me. Okay, so Lars wonders if she actually did know someone in Oslo after all, or maybe someone stole her key card and used it, but since cameras were never checked, we may never know. So, okay, Lars thinks that, okay, well, maybe she was in the drug smuggling trade, or she was a top-class prostitute. So, Lars then wonders if she could be a secret agent from some sort of intelligence service, from a different country, maybe, or maybe she's an assassin. So, Lars then explores this theory, and he tells how the Plaza Hotel was used for many closely guarded peace meetings that negotiated, you know, peace between different countries. And the only thing that doesn't make sense, and Lars wonders also, is how she could have stayed incognito for so long. Then we get this dude, and again, I suck with names, so I'm not completely sure that I'm saying this right. Ola Caldodger, who is he comes in, and he is a group leader for E14 Norwegian Intelligence Service, and he basically says that what he does is not exactly James Bond, but it was a kind of spying where getting information and getting people to say things that they, and then he takes a dramatic pause, don't want to say. So Olaf thinks that she was executed and it was a very well done carried out intelligence operation. And the gun she had was, okay, so then they look at the gun. The gun she had was illegal and the number had been removed in a professional way. So did she do it? Did whoever killed her do it? If somebody did kill her. So the original number is very deeply ingrained and a professional would know how deep to go to get rid of the number so it couldn't be identified who bought the gun or who sold it. So, back to the fact that all the labels had been removed from Jennifer's clothing. And OWASP says that that's normal procedure in the intelligence service because they all intelligence services are doing that now because you're going to have a cold operation because you don't want the police to track this back to some places or a country or something like that. So then he says that it's very common for that an agent would be away from their hotel room for such a long time, like Jennifer was away from her hotel room for 20 hours to, have a second place to go if something happens. So the fact that the door was locked from the inside means nothing, he says, because intelligence services have no problem with opening closed doors. He says there's no closed door for intelligence services. So, however, he says that it is hard to find out if they have manipulated it, and the fact that no one reported her missing or said anything. Ola says that if she was intelligence agent and she had been killed this way, both sides would be quiet. Dramatic pause again. Very quiet. So they would have gone to the family and said, "You have some money here. Keep quiet. Your daughter is a hero." And, he says this as though he's done this a lot of times, which is kind of concerning, but also kind of cool. So, then Lars asks if Jennifer was an intelligence service, then what else might she be? And Olaf responds with quotation marks, "I can't imagine that it could be anything else," quotation or end quote. And he, he's really sticking with it. And then we get this another very dramatic scene of Lars, and he's sitting down again in an empty office and at an empty table, and he says, "And suddenly I got an idea that, I remembered that we have technology now that we didn't have in 1995, and one thing that we didn't have was the DNA of the dead woman." So in 95, the DNA wasn't commonly used within the Norwegian police. They had kept a blood sample, but that was destroyed the year after when Jennifer was buried, sorry. So in fact, the police decided to destroy all the evidence to the case because this had to be a suicide, which, I mean, I kind of get from their perspective. They didn't want to mess anything up and they needed to move on to other cases. But also, come on, bro. So the only way to get the DNA of Jennifer was to go to her grave and open it. And as you can probably guess, that's exactly what Lars did. So on November 16th, 2016, Lars goes to Jennifer's grave and digs her up. So we see footage of the day, and it definitely looks like one of those days where, you stay home under a blanket and you watch cheesy romance movies and cry and order Grubhub and hope no one steals your order. Which is honestly what I would do. But Lars clearly isn't like most people, and he decides to go and just dig into a grave because, your average day in the life of Lars. So GS is like, "I was surprised that there was so much left of her after 20 years." And Lars is retelling the story, and you can tell that he's still very happy that there was DNA to get. So they get a full DNA profile, and when the results come back, they found that Jennifer, oh my God, he's saying that Jennifer was of European heritage. And according to police reports, one of the front desk operators says that she spoke with a German accent, specifically Eastern German. So Eastern Germany. Unfortunately, police are unable to identify her through DNA because there are no matching DNA profiles since no one has reported her missing. And on the registration card, Jennifer claimed to be 21 years old, and the doctor in charge of the autopsy landed on 30 years plus or minus 5 years, which gives us a gap of about 10 years. So Lars wants to determine her age a little more precise. So he talks with a Swedish professor who's also a forensic expert. So this professor teaches at Karolinska Institute in Sweden, and he tells Lars of this new technology that is used to determine the ages of victims. So the idea is that between the Cold War, between 1955 and 1963, there were a lot of above ground nuclear test bomb detonations across the globe. And then we get this dramatic wide pan video of a nuclear bomb blowing up. Which reminds me of the beginning of season two of The Umbrella Academy. Anyways, all these detonations above ground create an increase in the C-14 levels in the atmosphere. And certain structures like enamel in the teeth will incorporate C-14 that was in the atmosphere at the time. So we can see the date of an individual by looking at the C-14 content compared with the atmospheric levels. So they did that with Jennifer, and they got the result that she was most likely born in 1971, which makes her 24 at the time of her death. So Lars then decides to work with Europe's largest newspaper, and the Bild Zeitung, please don't at me, in Berlin. They have a reach of 10 million people daily, and Lars was hoping that someone might recognize her, and there were a couple tips and information. However, none of it really helped us solve this case, or, because if we had, then it wouldn't be an unsolved mystery. So then we get this kind of dramatic image of Lars giving a speech about how important it is to solve this case, and he's sitting on one of those little like walls next to the highway, and the wind is blowing behind him dramatically. But that is the end of this documentary. If you have any information about Jane Doe's identity, please contact VG Newspaper, or go to unsolved.com. So that is the end of episode 2 of volume 2 of Netflix's Unsolved Mysteries, A Death in Oslo. I hope that you enjoyed it, and again, this is not a substitute for watching the actual documentary. You should totally go watch it. It's great. And this is also the end of episode 1 of Brain Cell Massacre. I hope you didn't lose too many brain cells while listening to this. Feel free to leave a review, and I will look at those. And also, make sure to check out my website. And also, in the reviews, feel free to tell me if I should, do more of these, because this took forever to write. Yeah, I hope you enjoyed, and I will be releasing another episode next week. Thank you for listening.